Hello, friends. Welcome to the Book Spider podcast, in which hosts Hans Berger, Chris Malmberg, and myself, Patrick Barney, discuss literature as critically as our sometimes dubious intellects allow. This episode, we're chatting about a classic novel in the Gothic tradition, Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, important for helping to establish the suspense and psychological thriller genres. Rebecca follows an unnamed young woman who narrates her tale of meeting, falling in love with, and marrying Maxim de Winter, a wealthy widower. After a short courtship while on vacation in Monte Carlo, the narrator marries de Winter and moves with him to Manderley, his lavish brooding estate in Cornwall. And for those who are unfamiliar with British geography, Cornwall is the southwesternmost county in England. It's on this, like, kind of peninsula that juts out of the bottom of the island of Great Britain into the Celtic Sea. So it's, like, south of Wales, separated by, you know, some water. After arriving, the narrator discovers that the memory of de Winter's first wife, Rebecca, who died in a boating accident about a year previously, haunts the estate, threatening to destroy any happiness that she and de Winter might find. Perhaps most responsible for this atmosphere is Mrs. Danvers, the overbearing housekeeper whose cold hatred for the narrator culminates in tricking the narrator to wear a former dress of Rebecca's to a fancy costume party, which creates a rift between the narrator and de Winter. After this party, Mrs. Danvers reveals that she knew and loved Rebecca since she was a child, describing a sadistic, brutal person who liked to whip horses and play psychological power games. In a strange and hypnotic manner, Mrs. Danvers tries to get the narrator to jump to her death out of a nearby window. However, a shipwreck in the neighboring bay causes a thunderous disturbance, interrupting the hypnosis. In the aftermath of the shipwreck, as de Winter and others try to save seafarers and cargo, a small yacht is discovered at the bottom of the bay, which belongs to the first Mrs. de Winter, and which has a body inside of it. The discovery of the yacht prompts de Winter to confess to the narrator, his second wife, that his marriage to Rebecca was a sham. He married her for social status as well as to have a woman take care of Manderley for him. Ultimately, however, their arrangement soured as Rebecca's cruelty and selfishness became more and more apparent. Finally, one night, Rebecca claimed to be pregnant with another man's child whom she would raise as Maxim's, with Maxim powerless to do anything about it. In a rage, de Winter shot Rebecca and sank the yacht with her body in it to cover up his crime. Now that the yacht is uncovered, an inquest into Rebecca's death has begun. Despite some tricky questions, de Winter is able to avoid overwhelming suspicion and is released. And the inquest rules Rebecca's death a suicide, since the damage to the yacht that caused it to sink could only have been done by someone aboard. Later, though, a former lover of Rebecca's, Jack Favell, comes to Manderley looking to blackmail de Winter with a note from Rebecca written only hours before her supposed suicide, a note that suggests she had no intention of harming herself. This leads to further inquiries on the part of the authorities, ultimately leading to an interview with Dr. Baker, a London physician who had been treating Rebecca for terminal cancer shortly before de Winter shot her. This evidence both corroborates the inquest's ruling, since it provides a motive for Rebecca to commit suicide, but also apparently exonerates de Winter of Rebecca's murder, since it becomes clear that she manipulated him into shooting her. So, by apparently, I mean perhaps morally exonerates de Winter of Rebecca's murder. Though, you know, maybe that's a question we'll talk about. So, even though Rebecca did not actually commit suicide herself by drowning herself in her yacht, she did orchestrate her own murder, which may be a kind of suicide. So Dr. Baker's evidence that Rebecca had cancer and was going to die of it keeps de Winter out of prison. So the narrator is happy about this, and it starts to feel that, you know, she can finally have a life with her husband. However, on the drive back to Manderley from London, De Winter feels a terrible sense of foreboding and believes they need to get back as quickly as possible. When they at last arrive to Manderley, they discover that it is totally ablaze, and this is the final image of the novel, of its ashes borne on the wind. So, that's kind of a rundown of what the novel is all about. Anything you guys think I should add?
No, that seems very comprehensive to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I didn't get every detail, but I tried to, you know, get the important things.
I think you got the stuff that we would need to discuss the novel, yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that I'm interested in. Probably the thing that I think is most important in a literary criticism context is how this novel creates narrative tension. So what I want to know is, like, how does this novel keep you reading? At least for me, I mean, the first two-thirds of the novel, not a whole lot happens other than, you know, the narrator meets De Winter, she falls in love with him, they get married, and, like, at Manderley, not a whole lot happens, right? Like, she's just kind of stuck in this feeling of gloom and doom. But where does the forward momentum of the novel come from?
Well, I think the part of it comes from the, and I don't know totally if I can, I don't know if I have a great handle from a craft standpoint of exactly how this is done, but the narrator really is a very, very sympathetic, very compelling presence, right? The narrator is, there's something about, I think, the psychological intimacy with which we experience her kind of minute-to-minute insecurities and the kind of, you know, when she meets Max De Winter, there's this sort of rise and fall of hope and excitement and disappointment and kind of self-loathing that she cycles through very quickly based on fairly minimal external stimuli, right? There's a way that she's kind of reacting with great kind of emotional strength below the surface in to this courtship that she's having. And the way that that's portrayed, for one thing, I think, you know, is it just feels very authentic to real human experience and desire and emotion in a way that was really exceptional for 1938, right? Am I getting that year right? This was published in 38?
Yeah. 38 or 36,
Something like that. Yeah, but, you know, a time when, like, we were still in a little bit, I think, of a transitional phase into forms of kind of narrative perspective that if you think about 19th century and early 20th century narrative, there's not as much kind of real psychological authenticity, right? There's not necessarily a sense of, at least to like a modern reader, they don't always capture a kind of human subjectivity in a way that feels totally authentic to actual humanity, right? There's a stylization, particularly, you know, Victorian literature and a lot of the, you know, the most notable literature from around this time is things like, you know, Faulkner or Woolf, where there's a huge amount of experimentation that colors that kind of psychological intimacy in a different way, right? Because there's so much just stylistic innovation that there's a kind of distancing from the humanity. And the way that the narrator, the way that we as readers really kind of live with the narrator in her kind of moment-to-moment intimate thoughts is very compelling and very reasonably, to my knowledge, ahead of its time. And for me, a lot of the narrative tension came from that, right? I mean, if you think about the I'm sure we'll talk much more about this later, but like if you were to just describe the events of the story, they're really quite grotesque, right? And the fact that it comes to the ending that it does is absurd.
Right.
And it's very easy to lose sight of that while you're reading the novel because the narrative perspective is so sympathetic and compelling.
Right.
Assuming that, you know, it works for you, which it did for me, and it sounds like it did for you.
No, I think I definitely agree with that characterization. I found myself while listening to the audiobook, I found myself thinking about the quality of the narrator's introspection and how, like, especially in the first couple of chapters where she's middle-aged and looking back on events, mm-hmm. and I found the quality of her observations about middle age and the differences between middle age and like youth and love in youth to be quite engaging and quite like sympathetic. So I definitely see what you're saying there. Did you have something to add, Chris?
No, I think that frame does a lot of work, right? Because it really earns our you talking about how well crafted that opening is, just experiencing it, but then also mechanistically how it sets us up to know that something bad is going to happen, and so it kind of gives it creates that space for us to kind of be kind of looking into everything and trying to understand what might be coming for the narrator. And I think also we're very close to her, and she has so little agency. I mean, it's not just Mrs. Danvers and Rebecca and the specter of Rebecca. It's her husband, who's kind of menacing and strange even before we find out that he murdered his previous wife.
Right.
And so I think that along with the really well-crafted hint that something bad is coming, does a lot of that work very, very elegantly.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So it's just to kind of summarize for myself and maybe for our listeners, the narrative tension we think comes from the contrast between the intimacy and sympathy of the narrative perspective and the kind of the situations that we find her in, from like working for kind of a shitty
who was
that woman's name?
I don't remember her name.
What?
She was awesome. I don't remember her name.
Yeah,
either.
Yeah, definitely
she was
a good
terrible
character.
Oh my god.
Right. But we're at the beginning of the novel working for this kind of awful person, and then kind of coming under De Winter's spell, who, you know, he's intriguing, but he's certainly not necessarily benevolent. You know, she has a fear at one point during one of their drives that he's going to, like, push her over the cliff or something.
Yes.
Which is interesting because it does, like, foreshadow the fact that De Winter is a heinous killer. And then getting to Manderley and Mrs. Danvers, like, tries to gaslight her into, so it's the contrast between these kind of awful circumstances she repeatedly finds herself in and her personability, her personal sympathy. Do we agree with that?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, she is basically she's an appealing character who has no power or agency, And we want to see her gain power and agency. And we know from the introduction that she does eventually gain emotional and psychological status relative to Mr. De Winter. So we're curious to see how that occurs.
Right. So let's talk about, we've mentioned the ending a couple of times, and like, so let's specifically speak to what you just said, Hans, how the first two chapters hint that she eventually does get some agency. And I'm really interested in this technique as well, because we open the novel with these two chapters of a woman who's looking back on events, and it does seem like she has found the agency that you're talking about, and she still thinks of Manderly, but either things do seem to have calmed down for her and become stable and become contented. So this begins the novel. However, the end of the novel is of Manderly, the final image is of Manderly burning. So why do we think we end the novel there? Does this ending recast the opening chapters somehow? Or, you know, it's, we just didn't need to go back to the ending because we already saw it.
Well, I think there's enough, right? I understand why it stops where it does. I understand why it stops on a dramatic image, and it does stop in a point at which the conflict has been resolved and the emotional balance has shifted. I am very curious about, you know, if Du Maurier had written a sequel that kind of followed the 5 years of their lives after this, I would find that very interesting, right? And I get why it stops where it does.
Somebody else wrote a sequel.
Well, and I'll bet you it doesn't necessarily give me what I would want there, right? Because what I would be interested in would be the kind of day-to-day psychological dynamics, right, of this couple in the fallout from that event, right? Because we have a mechanism by which they can achieve equality of emotional power, but we don't know how the kind of gradual shakeout of that actual achievement would go, right? And Max, right, is, I mean, Max is, he's volatile. He's not a particularly good communicator, you know?
No, he's not.
He's not the most emotionally stable person in the world. So, yeah, I don't know. I personally am very curious about that, but perhaps it's best that that's left to the imagination.
Hmm.
From the standpoint of making a structurally satisfying work, I don't think it needs to be there, and it's probably a testament to the quality of the characterization that I personally would be really interested in it.
Right. So we've got some idea of you know, the why the novel ends with this final image. You know, it's a powerful image. The novel has also already kind of given us that resolution. Well, not necessarily. Well, yeah, an emotional resolution. It's given us that. So why not end on this strong image of Manderly burning? And you know, I would say also in some sense, maybe it's the novel's attempt to say, well, De Winter is not actually a good character or a good person. Like, he's punished by losing Manderly forever. That could be some type of poetic justice that the novel is pointing out. I'm not sure. But definitely,
yeah, it
interesting.
Does, it does. I mean, I suppose the fact that we're all assuming that Mrs. Danvers burned Manderly, right? Is that the conclusion we're meant to reach?
That's what I get.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the fact that there's not a little bit more about why she did that is, you know, you suggested, Patrick, that maybe the thematic or character, you suggested just now, Patrick, that maybe it's a little ambiguous what that's meant to reveal, either in terms of theme or character, or, I mean, obviously Manderley is very symbolic, right? But like, there's a little ambiguity about right. how to read the symbolism of that moment. And a lot of the reason there's that ambiguity is because we don't really know all the details of how it happened, right? I mean, like, it does seem out of character to me that Mrs. Danvers would just decide to randomly burn down this, you know, beautiful estate that she's devoted her life to, right? And you have to assume in some way that's Rebecca acting through Mrs. Danvers, right? Like, Rebecca somehow...
Right.
Rebecca knew she would do that, because Rebecca is kind of given that sort of omnipotence in the novel, right? She's given that level of manipulative right. ability. But the fact that we don't really know how Rebecca set it up so that that would happen, I think might be part of why it's a little hard to read. Kind of theme or character meaning into that event. Although I guess it's right. not that hard.
Right.
Well, Rebecca gives Mrs. Danvers as her name when she goes to see Dr. Baker. So there's a kind of a doubling there, right? Like, Mrs. Danvers is kind of like an avatar of Rebecca that like continues to execute, maybe not like explicitly like what, like, I don't know if I read it as like Rebecca scheming, you know, all of this, what would it be like? for some reason, my head went to like Ender's Game style, where it's like, and then this will happen, and then this will happen. And even after she's died and somehow put Mrs. Danvers up to finally destroying everything. But Mrs. Danvers, it's kind of the haunting aspect of the novel for me, like the mysterious ways in which Rebecca's will continues to exert force on the, like, the sequence of events. And Mrs. Danvers is just someone who is who was closest to Rebecca and is able to kind of channel that in such a way. It is like the most explicitly haunting aspect of the novel for me, thinking about it after you were just talking about it, Hans. Like, why does Mrs. Danvers burn down Manderley? And it's not necessarily clear, but it's just, it feels like that final destructive act from Rebecca, and Mrs. Danvers is the one to do it.
Right.
Yeah, I guess in some sense, I mean, when I started this novel, I had the vague idea that it might be either a ghost story or something like Turn of the Screw, that's like an ambiguous maybe ghost story. And I suppose if you want to read it if you want to be generous about how you define terms, right, like, Rebecca is in some sense possessing Mrs. Danvers from beyond the grave, right? It's like right. a ghost possession story that manages to occur in a non-supernatural framework, which is right. pretty clever.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely strikes me as very similar to a ghost story. Like, it's doing a lot of the same things that a ghost story would do. You know, for purists, they're not going to be happy, but what can you say about that?
This fucking ghost story
purists.
So let's think about the other important aspect of the ending, which is where we learn the twist, right? That De Winter was manipulated into killing Rebecca. Like, that's what we find out about from Dr. Baker. And what I'm interested in is, it's like a trick, right? Where you know, you the reader wants to feel like there's a happy ending in store, or that, you know, that the characters are getting what they deserve, or things are turning all right for the characters. But, you know, it's hard to do that when one of your main characters is a murderer. So does the reveal, does that change our attitudes? Does it, you know, does it give us any warrant to indulge our shallow, naive, romantic desires for the narrator to end up happy with De Winter? Or is it, like you said, Hans, just absurd and really quite just trash? What do we think?
I just want to, I did not use the phrase really quite just trash, I should say there.
No, you didn't. That's my phrase.
I think I called it grotesque, right? It's right, and grotesque. And I actually really appreciate the grotesquery of it, right? What happens is because we have so much investment in the narrator's ability to be happy with De Winter and take charge of the environment that she's been put in, any opportunity that comes along for her to do that will be gratifying, even if it is connected to this revelation that really undermines his you know, value as a character, right? And
right.
So I think it's, I mean, I called it grotesque, but I meant that in an admiring way, right? And I don't even know for sure if Du Maurier was, it's very hard to kind of, and this doesn't matter necessarily, right? But I'm not totally sure how much Du Maurier wanted us to perceive that as grotesque versus how much
right.
genuinely perceived it as sympathetic. I think there is the in most ways, like I said before, in most ways, this is a, I think, strikingly contemporary feeling novel for being written in 1938. Obviously, it's not set in the present, right? But like, if the story were written today, I think a lot of the narrative voice would feel very similar, right? A lot of the kind of, you know, the details and the kind of psychological details of how the character works, I think would actually be very similar. The one disadvantage I think that it does have, being from 1938, is that we don't really have a clear sense of why Rebecca was so loathsome. Right. If it were written, it ultimately all that stuff has to be left to the imagination. And for a while that probably worked. Right. But I mean, like, being somebody now who's very sex positive and very drink and drug positive and very, you know, I mean, if you read this as someone who attaches very little moral stigma to decadence, then it's very hard to feel, it's just very hard to feel that Rebecca deserves to be punished like that, right?
Right.
I mean, and that's probably the fact that the book's not able to be more explicit about what makes her loathsome, that does undermine the strength of that a bit. Around the time that I finished watching this, or not watching this, around the time I finished reading this, I don't know if this is a connection that many people would make, but I happened to rewatch Lost Highway, the David Lynch film, right?
Oh, yeah.
And Patricia Arquette, the blonde version of Patricia Arquette in Lost Highway, is kind of a Rebecca, right? I mean, like, Rebecca was sort of an early proto-femme fatale, and Patricia Arquette in Lost Highway is kind of like a postmodern late femme fatale, right? But they're versions of the same type. And there's a scene in Lost Highway, and I'm about to get, if this, you know, just content warning for listeners, I guess, I'm about to talk pretty explicitly about sexual content here. So I don't think anybody, you know, is going to be bothered by that, but FYI, you might want to skip ahead a couple minutes. But there's a scene in Lost Highway where the main character, you know, he's kind of fallen in love with this woman who he knows has kind of been involved in hanging out with these gross porn-selling mobsters, right? And at one point, he, like, breaks into a mansion that one of the porn mobsters owns, and there's this video being projected in a home projector of Patricia Arquette just getting railed from behind by this gross, sweaty, fat dude, right? And it's just the worst kind of low rent, shitty mob porn, you know? And it completely changes his perspective on her, right? And even though, like, as an individual, I certainly wouldn't think that any woman should be at all, you know, stigmatized or judged for participating in porn if she wants to, the image is so revolting that you can't help but have his reaction, leaving aside your own principles, right? And that's, that's, you know, Lynch had that kind of freedom to do that, that Du Maurier didn't. And that, you know, there's just, I just didn't ever feel the antipathy toward Rebecca that I wonder if maybe we were supposed to.
Right. Like, yeah, I definitely agree. Like, it's hard to, it's weird because, like, it's not like she manipulated De Winter into marrying her under false pretenses, right? From the beginning, De Winter and she were going to have a marriage of convenience. And, okay, so she parties a little too hard and, you know, brings it into the home. And maybe that's tawdry, or, you know, maybe it does show a lack of respect for De Winter, but is that a reason to be murdered? You know, is that a reason to be murdered? And I like how that's a good contrast that you brought up, Hans, because, like, it's not that Patricia Arquette character did anything wrong in Lost Highway. It's just the visceral gut reaction of a nasty image of her getting railed by a disgusting fat dude, right?
We understand as viewers how the narrator, not the narrator, we understand as viewers how the main character will respond to that,
right?
Even if we don't agree with it, you can't help get away from the kind of just gut punch.
Right. Like,
visceral reaction
bam.
To it, right? And it's not even like he's finding anything he doesn't know. It's just he understands it in a way that he didn't before, right?
Right.
And there's no equivalent to that, really, in Rebecca. I mean, the equivalent to that in Rebecca is she spurs her horse a little too hard.
Yeah. So, there could be, like, if Rebecca were made more loathsome, somehow we would understand. Even if we can't ever condone him killing her, we could understand it on a gut level a little bit better if Rebecca really had some real loathsomeness to her. I wonder how the new Netflix film of this book does it. I haven't watched it. I was thinking about watching it. I wonder.
Like, well, it's PG-13, so.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, and I am going to watch it. I've been meaning to watch the Hitchcock version for a while. I want to watch the Hitchcock version definitely, and I'll probably watch the new one. Armie Hammer's in it, and he's, you know, kind of a scuzzbag, so my wife may not want to watch it with me.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He is a scuzzbag.
But I may have to watch it on my own. We don't actually have a Netflix account, so it may be a while. But I will at some point, and I'll follow up with you guys about that. I guess that's no help to the podcast, but.
Well, I might watch it too at some point. I don't know.
It's funny, Hans. You mentioned it's like the novel's modern qualities, and then like where they aren't modern. And just going back to the reveal, not only did Rebecca have cancer, but Rebecca couldn't have children. So the whole, it really kind of exposes the whole confrontation she had with Maxim as a sham allegedly so that he would kill her. And the thing about all of that and the way that it's funny.
I just thought it was. I thought it was funny that you made sure to say allegedly there, like you're a journalist reporting on a, you know, somebody who's been arrested. You got to make sure we don't get sued by Rebecca De Winter.
Yeah.
Well, we do only have.
Yeah, we have it through
the perspective
Maxim.
Of the survivors, right?
Yeah. I mean, yes, I don't think.
No,
at
you're
the
not.
End,
you're not wrong. It was just it just struck me as funny. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you should be sorry, but I don't think Mr. De Winter seems really actually that capable of being conniving anyway. Like, we don't really get a lot of hints that he's really handling this very well toward the end. But what I meant to say was, the way all of this sort of works out, just sort of very neatly, reminded me of, and I think I'm like, it reminded me of like a Jane Austen novel, or is it like a Victorian, like sort of like domestic drama manners like style novel that in the end sort of a conspiracy of coincidence and then revealed past suddenly just sort of lets everyone off the hook and everything kind of just sort of writes itself? Because that felt, I didn't know if that was like if that was a thing in the 1930s, but it reminded me of like an older style of novel, and I can't speak very like
just
about that.
Just to jump in there, Chris, De Maurier admitted that Rebecca is in dialogue with and is very similar to Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte.
Oh, look at that. I handed you that segue there to that
yeah,
question.
You sure did. But I think that's an interesting thing to point out, that like the narrative beats in this novel do feel it, you know. Even if it's modern in a lot of ways, it feels, the ending certainly feels old fashioned in the sense of Jane Eyre or Jane Austen, you know, the one being a novel and the other being a novelist. And I was wondering, like, you know, is there any further use in comparing them? Are there other important things we can think about? Like when Jane Eyre ends, you know, the mansion that what's his name lived in was all burned up and he was all disfigured, but ultimately like he and Jane Eyre get together and are happy. And it seems something similar with this book, you know, Manderley's donezo, but ultimately De Winter and the narrator do get together.
I guess if you're wondering how much it's in dialogue with or in critique of Jane Eyre, I guess part of the question is whether or not we do in fact see it as grotesque that the narrator accepts this man who murdered his last wife, right? If we take that relatively straight-faced and say, well, he was driven to it, clearly he's not going to shoot the narrator because she's not evil, right? So there you go. Fine, happy ending. If you take that as it's presented on a straight level, then there isn't much critique of Jane Eyre there, right? If you see it as intentional, that this is a bizarre and grotesque decision that the narrator is essentially driven to by insecurity and fear, right? That a fully realized person would just, you know, leave. Then you could certainly see it as a critique of Jane Eyre, in as much as, you know, it tries to kind of spotlight the grotesquery of Jane accepting Rochester.
Hmm. So it could be a critique if we have an ending that's grotesque. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, my gut says the ending probably is not meant to be grotesque, but maybe not. That'd be I think it's better if it is grotesque. Like, I think,
well,
it,
I think
it's
that...
a better.
I mean, I think that maybe, you know, we might be placing, as many people often do, we might be placing too much importance on authorial intent, right? I mean, if the trick that's happening here is we are so invested in the narrator that we understand her decision and find it sympathetic, and that is a real, that's a real little authorial coup, regardless of whether or not Du Maurier thought that it was a reasonable choice for the narrator narrator to make, right?
Right.
So, and I think, I mean, it does to some extent take some of the possible, either way, regardless of how you think of what Du Maurier was trying to do, it is taking some of the implicit grotesquerie of Jane Eyre and distilling and magnifying it, which is an interesting effect.
Mm.
I think, I mean, there's a, when it's a really interesting moment, I think, craft-wise, if you really like isolate when the narrator learns that her husband killed Rebecca. She dives right into like examining her lack of reaction to it, right? Like there's no kind of like, there's no sort of dawning realization or anything like that. It's like, why am I not responding to this with anything other than love for my husband, who's a murderer? And it's really, there's a line in there, and I'm just going to paraphrase it from memory, where she says, now that she knows Rebecca was awful, she doesn't have to hate her anymore. And there's a really weird kind of like, that's a weird thing, right? Like for the narrator to feel entitled to hating someone when she thought that person was a good person, and then like being released from that hate when she learns that like Rebecca actually was like this awful person. And that there's a, I don't know, there's a moral kind of like physics there that I think opens up. I think it definitely opens up for me, like questioning like how, questioning the morality of the narrator. I think, like, you know, hating someone because they're good and then like not hating them because they're bad is just inherently interesting to me. And I think it is, I think for me, the novel does set up a way to read it where, not that Rebecca, you know, was a good person. I'm not sure that anybody in the novel has to be a good person. But that the De Winters are, it is grotesque how this novel ends.
Hmm.
You know, you could probably, and Patrick, you're probably the only one of the three of us that would actually be qualified to do this, but you could create a very interesting Nietzschean reading of this, right? In the context of like beyond good and evil, the idea of who is and is not a good character ultimately is interrogated and discarded as irrelevant in favor of the use of kind of individual psychological power to gain status and comfort. And that's actually kind of endorsed as a way of operating. So, I think if you wanted to approach this from a Nietzschean framework, there might actually be a lot of interesting things to find there.
Mm.
Now, you know, I might have oversimplified and misread Nietzsche in the way that I characterized that just now, but.
No, I mean, you didn't get too deep into anything, so I don't think you'd mischaracterize beyond good and evil.
I didn't really have room to
like you.
Didn't
you
have room
said,
to
hey,
say anything
we could,
too stupid.
Well, I'm just right. Like I'm just saying, you know, Nietzsche's book Beyond Good and Evil is about like ways of thinking that go beyond good and evil, right? And we could certainly do
I
that
mean, you'd
with
hope
this.
So.
Yeah, we could certainly do that with this novel. Though I do want to point out that I think it's in Beyond Good and Evil that Nietzsche said that society needs slaves in some sense or other to operate. So just F you, Nietzsche. You shouldn't have said that. Screw you. But either way.
So who's the slave here? I mean, not in our podcast, right? Obviously, you know, you're the slave in a podcast, yeah. but in the context
the
of
why
in the context
the
of why are you the slave of the podcast? Well, I guess not so much anymore now that
podcast.
All three of us share editing duties. But
oh,
who's the
sure,
slave
yeah,
in Rebecca?
Yeah. Fuck. That's a good question. So
I think Mrs.
Like,
Danvers is the slave, right? Sorry to short circuit the.
No.
Sorry to short circuit things.
You,
but Mrs.
Why
Danvers
do you think
is
Mrs. Danvers?
Yes, explain.
Because her entire being is dedicated to the worship of Rebecca and to the carrying out of what she believes her goals and ideas would be. I mean, we said earlier that in some sense this is almost like a secular ghost story where Mrs. Danvers is possessed by Rebecca, right? What is demonic possession but essentially ghost slavery?
Sure. Ghost slavery. Okay. I like that. So
that's also the title of my new doom metal band.
It's a real. I was going to say that's a good title for something. Ghost slavery.
Ghost slavery. Okay, so let's think about this novel in relation to our last podcast work, which was When We Cease to Understand the World by Benjamin Labatut. Hopefully I said that correctly. And so When We Cease to Understand the World seems to be, thematically, it's mostly interested in the psychological horror that we experience when we are faced with the contradiction between the reality of quantum physics and the human sense experience. So the human sense experience roughly conforms to classical physics, you know, where, you know, everything about how objects interact makes sense. Whereas when we get down to the subatomic level, we find that really crazy stuff happens. We can't ever seem to say where something is without measuring it. We can't ever seem to say that something has a certain property unless we measure it. According to the main three theories of quantum physics, the current theories, either non-locality, which is two particles affecting each other's properties despite the fact that they are at humongous distances from one another. Retrocausation, which is self-explanatory. Event B, which happens after event A, causes event A somehow. Or the many words theory. One of these three things has to be true. Everything we know about quantum physics is correct. So the book is about the psychological horror we experience when we kind of investigate this contrast. And so I picked Rebecca because it also seems to deal with psychological horror and psychological dread. And I'm wondering, is that it? Like, is it just about psychological dread and horror, or is there something more to be said about this similarity between these two books? Like, is Rebecca's murder a retrocausal suicide?
Oh. Oh. Okay.
I don't know. That was just bullshit. But you know what I'm saying.
I don't know about that, Patrick. Labatut's novel is sort of exploring the psychological horror, as you're calling it, response to when scientists reach the edge of what we feel we know and perhaps can know about the universe, and then potentially questioning what we feel like we know so far, and confronting the possibility of knowing far less or knowing nothing, and just uncertainty. Scientists confronting permanent bottomless uncertainty.
Right.
And I feel like there is a kind of a connection. I'm not sure if I could make it, but the narrator's need for certainty when it comes to her relationship to Mr. De Winter and the, you know, like the past with Rebecca, when that uncertainty resolves into an observed past with Rebecca, it does relieve the narrator of that horror of uncertainty. So there's something there. I'm not sure where to take it further, but it does, they're both, in both cases, horror is coming out of the unknown.
Right.
And yeah, I don't know where to take that though.
Yeah, Patrick, I wish I were a good enough bullshit artist to come up with a better relationship between these two books, but I'm really drawing a blank here.
That's okay. Well, I definitely agree with you, Chris. I think that they're both about uncertainty of some type, right? Like, or either uncertainty or faulty certainty. Like, so like when we cease to understand the world, it seems to be terrified not just of, you know, the limits of what we can know, but also maybe the fact that what we thought we knew is not really known. And that seems to be the case with the narrator of Rebecca as well, who is constantly in turmoil about, you know, does Maxim love me or does he still love Rebecca? You know, she's both uncertain and terrified about the ways that things could turn out. And that seems to be the case in a lot of different situations, from like her thinking maybe he's going to push her off the cliff, you know, to his reaction after the costume party. So I definitely think there's, you know, I like you, Chris, I'm not sure exactly what else there is to say about it, but I definitely think that psychological dread emerging from non-certainty is a thing that's going on in both of these works, I would say. So finally, you know, and this is just for me to have fun, because, you know, I think this book is interesting. I think that there's a lot of positive stuff going on in the book, like, you know, on the level of technique. But at the same time, you know, I'm not sure how, like, whether I think this book is great, whether I think it's good, whether I think it does some interesting stuff, but is ultimately kind of a bad genre novel. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think it's pretty good. I mean, I think it has a lot of overlap in terms of plot and characterization. It edges right up to being a bad genre novel in certain ways, I suppose, but because it was doing what it was doing in 1938, a lot of that can be excused. And just I think the quality of technique at the time it was written is, I think, quite really quite exemplary. And
sure.
The I mean, I think we've talked about this a little bit before, right? Like, I rarely read novels experiencing plot suspense, right? It's just not right. In my usual kind of repertoire of responses as a reader. I don't care that much about plot suspense. And I did read this wanting to know what would happen, which is a pretty rare experience for me. I mean, I think that when you sent us the question ahead of time, you asked, where would we rank this among the books we've discussed on the podcast?
Right. Yeah, that's
I'm
what
just
kind
of looking through the list, and I probably liked it more than a lot of what we've read, right? I mean, I liked it, just kind of going through what we've read in the last couple months, maybe the last quarter, I liked it more than a lot of these things, right? I liked it more than Sirius. I liked it more than Lookout Cartridge. I liked it more than We Came to the End. Eiffelheim, I thought was better, but that's, you know, that's a great book, so that's no, you know,
right.
No knock, really. I'd put it pretty solidly mid-tier. I mean, it's a lot better than a lot of things that we've read, but some of the things we've talked about on the podcast are my favorite books of all time, and I wouldn't rank it up there.
Sure.
Certainly a very good and effective work that I would not have read if you hadn't picked it for the podcast.
Sure. How about you, Chris?
I really liked it. I think it's, I guess, like, on its own merit, like, what it's trying to do, like it does it really well, and I loved reading it. So it's kind of unfair to compare it to, like, Against the Day or
right.
You
yeah,
know,
yeah.
Like, it's a really different thing. But I really liked it, though.
Like, it is unfair to compare it to, you know, a definitely worse book like Against the Day. I'm just fucking with you. I think, like, objectively speaking, Against the Day is definitely better than this, objectively speaking. You know, on an enjoyment level, I probably enjoyed reading this more because, you know, I didn't have
totally
to read
fair.
1,100 pages of utter bullshit. You know, that's not true either. It's not utter bullshit.
Patrick, you're thinking of Lookout Cartridge.
Oh, man. Yeah, Lookout Cartridge was 800 pages of, like, just pure...
Patrick, it was 600
garbage.
Pages of unadulterated garbage. Let's not exaggerate.
Each of those pages counts for a page and a half.
Though. Yeah. It's like that cartoon I've seen where a philosopher goes to hell and the devil gives him a copy of Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. And he's like, this copy's great. It gets 2 pages longer for every page you read. So...
So, Chris, you were telling me, you and I had a phone conversation the other day in which you told me that you were actually thinking you wanted to revisit a few of your picks from the last couple of years, like maybe we didn't get enough out of them, and you actually wanted to read Against the Day again for the next episode?
Oh, Jesus.
No, I didn't. I didn't. Hans is lying.
Hans, why would you do that to me?
It's all a ploy, an elaborate ploy.
Without me is bad enough. I feel so horrible and let down. And then you're going to make me read Against the Day again?
I'm not going to, not yet. I chose Billiards at 9:30 by Heinrich Böll. It's a translated novel. I think the Kindle version is the version that I have in hard copy. It is a frame story of sorts from what I can tell. And, that is why I picked it. Other than that, there's nothing else. I have not read this. So I just stumbled upon it in a bookstore and I really want to read it.
All right. You heard it, everybody. The next thing we're going to read is Billiards at 9:30 by Heinrich Böll. This podcast, though, we discussed Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. Pretty interesting novel with lots of technological advancements for its time. So I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. And, you know, as usual, fuck the fash. Peace out.